It's the biggest development since the start of the Israel-Gaza war about 7 weeks ago. Israel and Hamas reached a deal that pauses fighting in Gaza. As of Monday afternoon, Hamas has freed dozens of hostages in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel. In Israel, families united, cheering the hostages' return. Claire Parker has been in Israel covering the releases as these suspenseful days and nights unfolded.
It is Friday, November 24th. There's a lot of uncertainty still. It's unclear first whether it will hold. It's unclear what will happen next. It's very uncertain in what condition the hostages will arrive medically, physically and emotionally.
We still don't have a lot of information about the conditions that hostages endured, but their family members have started sharing some details. Eyal Nari, whose aunt Adina Moshe was released by Hamas on November 24th, spoke about her condition.
She was in complete darkness. She had to adjust to the sunlight. She was walking with her eyes down.
There's going to be basically a long road of recovery ahead.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. It's Monday, November 27th. I'm your guest host, Lillian Cunningham. Today, we speak with The Post's Cairo bureau chief, Claire Parker, who's in Israel right now, about the latest on how this major moment came to be, what happened, and what might come next. So, by now, it's been more than a month since Hamas attacked Israel and killed at least 1,200 people there, and since Israel invaded Gaza, killing more than 13,300 Palestinians. How significant, Claire, is this pause and this hostage prisoner release that we've seen?
It's hugely significant. It's the first pause in hostilities since the war began, and is providing Palestinians in Gaza with a much-needed moment of relief from really relentless Israeli bombardment. And then for Israelis, a huge victory for hostage families who have been trying so hard to push for a deal to bring their loved ones home from Hamas captivity.
And so what were the initial terms of this deal?
So the deal was structured as a 4-day pause in fighting with possibility for extension. And under the deal, the International Committee of the Red Cross said it would work as an intermediary in transferring hostages held in Gaza to authorities in Israel and then Palestinian prisoners from Israel to the West Bank. And basically, this worked according to a 1-to-3 ratio. So for every one Israeli hostage that Hamas released, 3 Palestinian prisoners would be freed from Israeli jails. And then as part of this deal as well, additional humanitarian aid is supposed to come into Gaza and has been coming into Gaza. And medical supplies have been distributed to hospitals in Gaza. So it's allowed for a little bit of relief of the humanitarian situation there.
Mm-hmm. And so how did this deal happen? Like, who brokered it?
So it was a long time in the making. It followed weeks of talks between Israel, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, which represented Hamas, because Israel and the U.S. don't talk to Hamas directly. So both the Qataris and the Egyptians played key roles as intermediaries in helping to broker the deal, and the talks took place in Doha, the Qatari capital.
Obviously, there were lots of family members who were anticipating this exchange, this release. Did you connect with any family members before this was happening? How were they feeling about it?
So I've been in touch with a number of families of hostages who are still in captivity in Gaza. And one of the people I've spoken with is Gil Dickman, who's 31 years old from Tel Aviv.
The weeks and months past October 7th were a complete nightmare for us.
And his cousin, Carmel Gatz, 39, was taken hostage on October 7th from Kibbutz Be'eri, where she lives. And her sister-in-law, Yarden Roman Gatz, is also believed to have been taken hostage that day. And Gil told me about how much of a nightmare the past weeks have been for him and his family, the agony of not knowing what happened to their relatives.
We don't have additional information about where they are or whether they're dead or alive. All we know is that they're kidnapped, and we assume that it's in the hands of Hamas, but we don't know for sure.
You know, continuing to have days go by without any sense of when they'll be coming home. But he's also found some support and solace and kind of uplift from other families of hostages who have really banded together to both support one another, but also to advocate, to protest, to call for their relatives' release.
People always look at you with the kind of eyes full of mercy, with a look full of mercy. But, like, we're all in this, and we can all understand how we all feel.
And so, could you just walk us through how all of this went down, like how it worked starting on Friday when the releases really began?
Yeah, so the deal took effect on Friday with a pause in fighting first at 7 a.m. local time. And at that point, you know, the guns went silent. The fighting inside Gaza stopped, and Hamas and Palestinian militants stopped firing rockets into Israel. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza stopped as well. And then that was followed by sort of hours of waiting for the first, you know, hostages to be gathered, located, and then handed over to the Red Cross to bring back to Israel. And sort of in the lead up to that moment, which ended up happening in early evening, Israel was preparing to receive the first group of hostages, getting hospitals ready for medical treatment, putting psychologists and social workers on standby to wow. basically work with the former hostages and their families to reintroduce them to society and to their lives. And for many of them, their lives have changed quite a bit after October 7th. So it's going to be a long process.
And so then what happened next? What happened on Saturday? What did we see happen sort of over the course of the weekend?
So these releases continued Saturday and Sunday. Saturday, there was sort of a bit of a hiccup in which there was a delay, and Hamas was saying that Israel had not upheld its side of the bargain by allowing sufficient humanitarian aid under the deal in and into northern Gaza. And so there was this period where it kind of seemed like it all could fall apart. But in the end, the second batch of hostages was released. And that happened again on Sunday. It was difficult for Israeli authorities to get a handle really on how many possible hostages were in Gaza. And part of what's complicated that is that some are held by groups other than Hamas, other militant groups in the Gaza Strip. And so Hamas doesn't even have a full tally of all the hostages. But the estimate that Israeli authorities have been working with ahead of this deal was that there are about 240 hostages in Gaza. And since the deal took effect on Friday, 58 of them have been released. And those include 40 Israelis and then 18 non-Israeli nationals. So the majority of them are Thai workers, 17 Thai workers, and then one Filipino man who is a caretaker for an elderly Israeli man in one of the kibbutzes in the south that was attacked.
Do you know anything about how these hostages who've been released, how they're doing, how they were treated?
So the hostages themselves have been sort of very protected and insulated from the media. And I think, you know, partly this is the realization that these are very vulnerable people who have come out of a very traumatic experience. And also, Many of them are children or elderly women. So we haven't heard from the hostages directly, but some of their family members have given statements to the media, and we've heard from some of the directors of the hospitals where they're staying, who say that most of them are medically stable, not all of them. There's an 84-year-old woman who was released Sunday who's in critical condition because she had not received the medical care that she needed while in captivity. And otherwise, what we're sort of understanding so far from these family statements and from what is getting out about the treatment of hostages was that they reported that they were, you know, underfed and forced to sleep on benches, but did not account. We haven't received any accounts so far of hostages having experienced violence or physical abuse at the hands of their captors. And then it seems like what we're understanding is that there's sort of a range in the access to information that people had while in captivity. So some had access to Hebrew radio and they were able to learn about what happened to their relatives and their communities on October 7th. But for others of them, they're emerging from 50 plus days of captivity. They don't know what's happened during that time. And they're finding out that their husbands, their parents were killed on October 7th and their communities have been completely destroyed.
I know one of the children we saw released was a 4-year-old girl, a U.S. Israeli citizen. What do we know about her?
Yes. So her name is Abigail Eden, and she turned 4 on Friday while still in captivity. And she was finally released on Sunday. And she's become sort of a symbol of the hostage crisis. President Biden has spoken about her repeatedly as she's American-Israeli, as you mentioned.
She's free, and Jill and I, together with so many Americans, are praying for the fact that she is going to be all right. Thank God she's home.
And she was taken hostage on October 7th after her parents were shot dead by militants that day. And her two older siblings were able to hide and escape capture. But she's been by herself in captivity, a toddler, for 50 days. And so there's, you know, a lot of concern about her well-being. We, you know, obviously haven't heard from her directly, but her aunt gave a statement to the media last night after she was flown to a hospital in Israel and said, basically, we're taking care of her as a family. She has relatives. You know, she might be an orphan, but we're supporting her.
She has family and we're taking care of her. So don't worry about it. And it's very important to let her be now with the family. And no press and photographs and paparazzi. It's very important for her safety and health right now.
There's a lot of mixed emotions these days, I think, for those families who are still waiting. I've spoken to several of them and they say, you know, they're really happy to see women and children, hostages, come home. But their message is basically, we need everyone home. We need all of them home and our loved ones too. And so that's going to be their fight going forward. And they're not stopping their advocacy both within Israel and abroad, especially in the United States, to push for that to happen.
After the break, what we know now about Palestinians released from Israel, and how much longer there will be a pause in the fighting. We'll be right back. So, in exchange for the hostages, Israel released Palestinian prisoners. And a colleague of ours, the Post's Louisa Lovelock, was in the West Bank when those prisoners were returning to crowds in the street. I just want to play a dispatch from her.
This was the moment on Friday that 23-year-old Asila Titi reunited with her mother, Hitam, after more than a year in jail. It was getting late into the evening by this point, and Hitam had been waiting all afternoon for her daughter. In these clips, you can hear that she's overcome with emotion. She says that her heart is on fire.
So Louisa told us that Titi was arrested for a fight with a prison guard when she visited her brother in prison. What else, Claire, can you tell us about the Palestinian prisoners who were released and how that unfolded in the West Bank?
So the majority of the Palestinian prisoners on this list of 300 possible detainees who could be released under this deal are male teenagers arrested in the past 2 years, ranging in age from 14 to 18. And then there are about 30 women and girls on the list. And the prisoners are accused of a variety of crimes that range from throwing stones to attempted murder. But the details on a lot of them are rather murky. Not all of them have been convicted, as far as I understand, and it's sort of unclear what exactly the severity of the crimes are. And for Palestinians, though, I mean, this prisoner release is a big deal. There were huge crowds gathering in the West Bank on Friday evening and every evening since, waiting for the releases to occur, people celebrating, people greeting the released prisoners like heroes, hoisting them on their shoulders, you know, crying out in joy. Israeli security forces kind of tried to clamp down on this with tear gas and kind of crowd containment mechanisms. But it was a real moment of joy for the families of those prisoners who were released as well. In West Bank refugee camps, where many of these prisoners live, there's this feeling, though, that even though this is a moment of joy, it's a bit tempered by the knowledge that, you know, given the clampdown and daily or weekly raids and arrests of Palestinians across the West Bank by Israeli security forces, that it's just kind of part of this endless cycle of arrests and releases and that happen under Israeli occupation in the West Bank.
And so this deal included a pause in the attacks in Gaza and also the transfer of humanitarian aid. What happened there? You know, what does this aid that was able to get into Gaza mean for people's lives there?
So it's, you know, huge in one sense, but also nothing in another. And aid groups have been making this point that it's really the amount of aid under this deal is getting scaled up, including some fuel trucks, which are incredibly needed for operating really everything in Gaza, bakeries, hospitals, you know, even driving the trucks of aid themselves. And so this is really essential, desperately, desperately needed aid it's really a besieged enclave. It's, you know, there's only been a trickle of aid coming in. People are desperate. They're displaced. They are living in unsanitary conditions. Disease is beginning to spread, says the World Health Organization. And so it's basically providing much needed relief. But aid groups are quick to say it's not at all enough. And they're calling for a permanent ceasefire and more aid to be sent into Gaza as well.
Claire, how fragile was this release deal? I mean, more hostages have since returned to Israel and more prisoners have been released in the West Bank. But you mentioned that there was a momentary stop to the release process on Saturday. Tell me more about what happened there.
So there was a 7-hour delay to the release process Saturday, and this was only day two of the 4-day pause in fighting and hostage release. And so it was a scary moment for many families of hostages and also for people in the Gaza Strip who were kind of nervously waiting to see whether this pause in fighting would collapse. And that delay was after Hamas said that, among other things, Israel was not allowing humanitarian aid to reach parts of northern Gaza that need it. And so it seemed as if the deal was kind of on the verge of falling apart. And Hamas also said that Israel was not upholding the ratio that had been established under which 3 Palestinian prisoners would be released for every 1 Israeli hostage. And so there's a 7-hour delay. There was emergency diplomacy by Qatar and Egypt. kind of furious talks to keep this thing going. And then in the end, on Saturday, Hamas did release another 13 Israeli hostages, and Israel set free 39 more Palestinian prisoners.
And so now it's been, you know, more than a month since October 7th when those first hostages were taken. What were some of the other factors and forces that made this deal possible? Like, what role did these families play in helping this to come about?
So the families played a significant role, and they really helped to turn public opinion in favor of at least a temporary pause in fighting to allow for the release of these hostages. After October 7th, I mean, Israel was reeling from the attack. There was sort of a desire for both revenge and then also to stamp out Hamas, as that has been the stated goal of the Israeli government and military since the war began. And a lot of concern among officials and military leaders at first that any sort of pause in fighting would allow Hamas to regroup. But then the families over time, they've launched this campaign from the get-go, plastering posters with all of the hostages' faces and names and ages all over. I mean, you walk in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or really anywhere in Israel, and you see these photos on bus stops, on buildings, projected on the sides of buildings.
Wow.
So they basically made these hostages impossible to ignore. And then I think their sort of personal stories really just tugged at the heartstrings of the Israeli public. And eventually got Netanyahu, the prime minister, and his security and defense establishment, the top leaders of the various security wings, to kind of line up behind this deal.
So, Claire, we're talking on Monday. It's Monday evening where you are in Israel. And right now the pause is still happening. How much longer do we expect that there will be this pause?
So under the original deal, this would have been the final day, but the deal did leave open a possibility for extension. The terms were sort of, if Hamas releases an additional 10, for every additional 10 hostages they release, there could be another day added of pause in the fighting. And so we received news Monday that there will be a two-day extension of this pause. We believe still Israeli women and children will be released during that time.
What about Gil? When you last checked in with him, you know, what has he told you about his relatives and his perspective on what's still unfolding?
So his relatives have not been released yet. And he's certainly sort of in the camp that is pushing for a longer pause. And I think, you know, hostage families are sort of divided in some ways over, you know, what the kind of longer term solution should be. But Gil at least is hoping that this pause, this release of hostages and prisoners, kind of portends a more peaceful phase of the war.
And it's the victory of life over death in general, not only within the fight of the hostage families, and not only in Israel, but also in the whole world, because the debate here is what's more important to you right now, the life of people on both sides, or, you know, revenge and blood.
Israeli leaders, though, have signaled that they have no intention of stopping the war. This is not to them a prelude to a ceasefire. And that we're hearing from analysts and signals in Israeli media that the next kind of target will be Khan Yunis in Gaza, in southern Gaza, which is a densely populated area where residents before the pause have received leaflets telling them to evacuate, which could signal a bombing campaign there. And so, you know, it, I think a lot of Gazans are very afraid and probably, unfortunately, rightly so, that a fresh wave of bombing is coming their way very shortly.
Claire, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And, you know, even more importantly, thank you for all of the incredible reporting that you're doing there.
Thanks for having me.
Claire Parker is the Cairo bureau chief for The Post, currently reporting from Israel. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Alana Gordon and mixed by Sean Carter. It was edited by Monica Campbell with help from Rena Flores. Thanks to Louisa Lovelock, Jesse Mesner-Hage, Ariel Plotnick, and Emma Talkoff. You've been hearing a lot about Washington Post subscriptions from us lately, because ad-free audio is now available for all Washington Post subscribers in Apple Podcasts. But here's another reason to subscribe. It's our biggest sale of the year. Our Black Friday sale runs now through November 29th. You can get a whole year of The Washington Post, plus that ad-free audio, for just 99 cents every 4 weeks. Don't miss the chance. Just go to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. And thanks. I'm your guest host, Lillian Cunningham. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.